It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Dr. Karen Hacker is leaving Wednesday as director of the Allegheny County Health Department after 6 years to become the director of the National Center for Chronic Disease Prevention and Health Promotion at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia. Dr. Hacker, congratulations and thanks for making the time today.
Thanks so much for having me.
In your 6 years with the County Health Department, you've tried to address obesity, lead, air pollution, opioids, and more. Is there any one arena where you think we've made the most progress?
I think the opioid crisis is actually one of the areas where you've made such a major impact. We saw a 41% drop in the number of people who died in this last year in 2018. Which is extremely significant, as you can imagine.
Very good news. But can that figure be misleading in a sense because the availability of naloxone was really widespread over the last year or two for victims?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things we really don't know is how many people are currently using, how many people are using naloxone now in the privacy of their own location. We know that they're not calling 911 or going to the emergency room at the same level. I consider it a bit of a black box. We don't know all the things we need to know so that as we move forward, we can adjust our interventions. We are on target, I believe, and have just heard from the CDC that we will be getting a very large grant from them, which should help us in that area. We do not know the exact amount yet. You may recollect it was for over $5 million a year for each of the 3 years, and we have a lot of partners that will be working on that.
And how will that grant be used?
One portion of it, it's very required elements. The first and foremost is around surveillance. So how do we get at some of the information that you were just alluding to? Can we actually begin to understand the number of new users, for example? We also would like to know more about whether the drug supply is changing in some way. Are people actually moving from an opioid or heroin or fentanyl to, for example, methamphetamine? There's also a fair amount for connecting people to treatment services, for various diversion programs with police, for a lot on education, a whole educational campaign. So we're going to have to see what they ultimately fund.
What is it going to take in terms of state and federal support to really make a dent?
So from my perspective, the real underlying issue is why are so many people vulnerable to getting addicted to various drugs? And this happens to have been a very lethal drug to get addicted to. And as I'm sure you know, the volume of oral opioid medications that was available made this a perfect storm, as we sometimes refer to it as. But the issue is we have a lot of folks who are going to probably migrate to other drugs. And the question then becomes why and what can we ultimately do to stop people from using these substances in the first place? And then how good is our treatment and what's available for treatment? So, for example, as we know, medication-assisted treatment is very evidence-based, but its availability is somewhat limited. And we'd like to see more primary care physicians, for example, be able to offer buprenorphine in their offices.
Conversely, is there a health challenge where you think the department fell a little bit short, whether it's pollution or another one of the things that I mentioned earlier?
Well, I would say there's, rather than say we fell short, I think it's that these are issues that are going to take a longer time. You've got to be in it for the long haul. And 6 years on the grand scale of public health issues is a very short time. So whether it's obesity, which we know takes decades to really change given our eating habits and our food availability, or whether it's the air quality that we're constantly working on and trying to reduce. I would also argue, though, one of the big challenges is health inequities, the issues that we have geographically across our county, where some areas of our county are suffering so much more than others from a whole variety of negative health outcomes.
Our region has been dealing with air pollution for decades and decades. You said the solution takes a long time. The problem has developed over a long time. It came front and center December 24th, the fire at the Clerton Coke Works, and another fire in June. Fines were levied but challenged by U.S. Steel. At any time, did you feel frustrated in what you could or couldn't do about resolving this issue, specifically with Clerton Coke Works?
Well, I think any time you have to deal with due process, it can be very frustrating, right? So anything that we do as a regulatory agency First of all, it has to be extremely well thought out because it's got to be able to stand up in court. And as you saw in these scenarios, U.S. Steel decided they were going to appeal pretty much everything we did. We were lucky that they didn't get a stay, and so they were still required to do the things that we required them to do. The other thing is that a lot of the data that we get from our monitors is not ultimately adequate to tell us exactly what's happening at the plant at any given time. So, for example, with that fire, we did not have information on how much SO2 they were actually releasing from their stack at Irvin until 2 months, I think, after the fire, and we were still getting it in after that episode completed. Now, the good news there is we really understood what was going on when they had the second fire. Because of that, we were able to jump in much faster and say, look, we know that the mitigation strategies you were using were not making a dent, and therefore, you got to stop this, repair the equipment immediately, or shut down.
What was it like trying to ease the health concerns of residents, particularly in the Mon Valley?
I think anytime the health department issues a warning, for example, even though we were saying to people, we just want to alert you to this situation, it's going to raise a lot of anxiety. And, you know, as you mentioned, these individuals have been living with this for decades. There is a legacy of pollution, particularly in the Mon Valley. The good news is it is getting better, but I think people are waking up to really understanding what's going on. And with that, they're starting to say, we don't want to tolerate this anymore.
Should they be hopeful? Are you hopeful for them as you get ready to leave?
So I think the activities that we've been involved in over the course of the last 2 to 3 years have been pushing, and seem to be getting some results and getting U.S. Steel to say that they're going to be doing various things. For example, this whole $1 billion project that they're talking about. But ultimately, we have no control over whether they actually do the project or not. You know, they'll ask for a permit. Ultimately, I'm assuming the department will permit them. But in the long run, we have no regulatory authority to require them to complete that work. Anything that we do in our settlement, which, you know, we just released a settlement and there's going to be a public hearing. With that said, that is going to be required. Anything in that settlement, we do have regulatory authority over. So that is one of the biggest challenges, I think, in working with industry, is that you can fine them, you can require things, but it becomes very difficult to require actual changes to the equipment, for example, unless that happens through some types of agreement.
You had, I believe, threatened to shut down Clairton Coke Works if the company didn't get a better handle on the pollution. Shut down or hot idle? I mean, in other words, cease operations or go to hot idle, not producing the coke.
So it is considered hot idle because, if you probably know, the batteries basically will be destroyed if they actually are turned off. There isn't really a switch, not to mention it takes quite a long time to get them into hot idle. However, hot idle means you are not producing. So the impact to the company in terms of not producing their product obviously is quite severe.
You said there have been improvements, but the county still struggles to meet federal air quality standards. What other steps must be taken overall for air quality in this region?
You know, I think that the continued monitoring of where we are, the use of every tool that we possibly have. We've also asked the state legislator to get involved and to think about providing additional tools to us during times, particularly should there be these kinds of episodes where equipment actually fails or breaks down. Redundancy of equipment, things like that, would be very important. Bottom line is, you're going to have to monitor this, make sure that everything you're expecting to happen is happening, bring your data in as quickly as possible, and then take action.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Our guest is Allegheny County Health Department Director Dr. Karen Hacker, who is leaving this week to join the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. So your new position, you'll be Director of National Center for Chronic Disease Prevention. What will that entail?
So it's a very large center. It's got, I believe, 8 or 9 various different divisions that include cancer, heart disease, diabetes, the nutrition, physical activity, tobacco, dental, reproductive health, and I believe population health. I may not be getting all of them. Mm-hmm. So it's a totally different platform in that it's a national platform, and it really is a way to provide leadership around these chronic disease prevention and health promotion.
What have you learned in your time here that might inform your approach at CDC?
Oh, I don't even know how to start. I think the work at the local level that I've been involved in understanding how implementation actually happens is absolutely critical for informing what happens at the CDC. And I think that's one of the reasons they were interested in me. You know, you write a grant, you write a proposal, and a lot of the time the people writing the RFP don't really understand what's happening in the field and whether or not it's going to work or not. And I think that's where my skill set lies.
If you're just joining us, I'm Kevin Gavin. We're speaking with Dr. Karen Hacker, outgoing director of the Allegheny County Health Department. Do you think here in Allegheny County we have an adequate understanding of health disparities, whether it's by race, income, neighborhood?
You know, over the last 6 years, I put a lot of energy into building our statistics and epidemiology and data resources. And I think what we've been putting out there has really informed exactly what you're talking about, which is these health inequities. And I'd say at this point, we know what the problems are. Now the question is, what can we do to change them?
So what is your advice to
So I would do? Call it targeted interventions. We have recently received a CDC grant focused specifically on the African-American population and targeting communities that have a disproportionate burden of a whole variety of chronic diseases. We've also started talking about a district office in the Mon Valley and are hoping to get that up and started this year. I think that gives us an ability to work in some of the communities where we know these health inequalities exist. And I think that in the future, I would hope that the department would do the same for some of the other areas that continue to bear that burden.
Dr. Hacker, do you think Western Pennsylvania is getting a handle on addressing children's exposure to lead?
So, as you know, the whole issue of lead really revived itself after Flint and after PWSA had the elevation and lead in their pipes. With that said, the numbers of children impacted by lead exposure has been going down nationally for years, and certainly after they removed lead from gasoline and paint and, you know, pipes and things like that. But this was both a challenge, but also, I think, an opportunity. And the fact that we actually were able to get universal lead testing in Allegheny County for the first time is giving us way more information on how many children are being exposed. So we've identified, while the rates are going down, we have identified more children with lead exposure at a much lower level than we were previously. I think the whole point of universal screening is to say to people, not everybody who needs to be tested is getting tested. And the idea here is to pick people up as soon as possible, get these children as soon as possible. Now we're trying some prevention strategies, try to get into homes before a child is exposed.
Are you seeing a welcoming of people from people to have you come into their homes?
No, I'd say that's still difficult. We've just tried some work in one particular community and going literally door to door, not even us, working with a community organization to do that. And the vast number of people don't want you in their homes. They might say, well, I know there's a problem, but I'm going to handle it or something like that. So part of this is really increasing awareness of the public.
First time I spoke with you in 2013, I think it was just before you actually started the County Health Department, you mentioned one of your priorities going in was to reduce the obesity rate. What specifically has been done to accomplish that?
So I will say, unfortunately, the rate hasn't been dropping. It's been staying fairly stagnant. I think the first thing, though, that we have been able to accomplish is working with many partners is expanding the access to healthy food. We've worked with various organizations like Just Harvest and the Food Bank and the Food Policy Council to get mobile units out into places, to expand farmers markets, to allow people, for example, who have WIC to actually get healthy fruits and vegetables. And I think that's a start, but ultimately people are still going to eat what they're going to eat. And then the challenge is, if you can surround folks with those options, can you also get them to choose those options? And even these communities where we have what would be called food deserts don't seem to have a problem with fast food. So it's going to be, again, these chronic diseases are in it for the long haul.
One of the initiatives you started was Live Well Allegheny to get companies, schools, communities to adopt practices to improve health. More and more get added to the list. Are you confident that Live Well will outlive your tenure?
I am, because I think the folks in place who are working on it are really passionate about it. We're over 50% of the county now that is actually engaged in doing this, and they're doing all kinds of exciting things focused on the built environment, focused on health information for their constituents. And with 130 municipalities, we have a lot of partners. So yes, I am hopeful. I do think it is one step, as I also mentioned, all the food access issues. There's a lot of work going on in schools. Many partners are now trying to get healthier options into schools, more physical activity. And I think that there should be a look at various policies as well.
As you look ahead for Allegheny County, what still needs to be done? What advice would you give your successor to continue to improve health in Allegheny County?
So I think the first thing that my successor will experience that I did not is that there's a department that's in relatively good shape and it can operate. And now the challenge is to keep moving forward. Whether it's air quality or lead or opioids or whatever the new emerging issue is going to be, all of the chronic diseases, the new director needs to be innovative, needs to be a good manager, and I think needs to continue to push forward.
Dr. Karen Hacker is wrapping up 6 years as director of the Allegheny County Health Department. She'll be the director of the CDC's National Center for Chronic Disease Prevention and Health Promotion. Dr. Hacker, thanks so much and best wishes on your future venture.
Thank you so much, and thanks to all of the citizens of Allegheny County.
A Board of Health appointed committee has begun a nationwide search for Karen Hacker's replacement. During the transition, Deputy Director Ronald Sugar will serve as Interim Director of the Health Department. I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Kylie Kaczynski, still ahead on The Confluence. A nearly 30-year-old troupe of performing artists has taken its performances from a Pittsburgh scrapyard all the way to Broadway. This weekend, Squonk Opera is finally getting its Three Rivers Regatta debut. And Canonsburg-based Mylan is close to a merger with a business that belongs to pharmaceutical giant Pfizer. What does this mean for jobs here in Pittsburgh? Get conversations, stories, and more from this and past episodes of The Confluence at wesa.fm/confluence.
Sublime released their landmark self-titled album on this day in 1996. It was their first on a major label, and it was massively successful, selling over 5 million copies. That success, however, was bittersweet as the group's leader, Bradley Knoll, died from a heroin overdose 2 months prior. It was just a week after he got married, 11 months after the birth of his child, and just under a year before Sublime's first number one single, What I Got. For 91.3 WYEP, I'm Joey Spehar.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Take the world's largest pharmaceutical company, Pfizer, add one of the world's largest producers of generic drugs, Mylan, and what do you get? Well, we're about to find out. Paul Goff is a reporter for the Pittsburgh Business Times. He's covering a newly announced merger between Mylan and Upjohn, a division of Pfizer. Paul, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
So Pfizer is creating what is called a hybrid drug company, merging Mylan with Pfizer's Upjohn. What are the similarities between Mylan and Upjohn? What do they do? What do they don't do?
Mylan is primarily a generic pharmaceutical company, and it has other operations as well, some over-the-counter, but it's primarily generic drugs. And Upjohn has off-brand patent, off-patent drugs like Celebrex and Viagra, and the two of those are not the highest margin type drugs that are being sold.
So they don't make the biggest profits on a sale.
Right, because they're off their exclusivity, so a lot of different companies could buy it, sell the type of drugs that they're making.
Mm-hmm. Why does Pfizer think this is a good marriage between Upjohn and Mylan?
I think what Pfizer would like to do is spend less time and effort with generics and off-patent drugs and spend more of their money and their development and their sales on drugs that make more money, newer drugs.
This combination of Pfizer's Upjohn and Mylan, is that different than what other large pharmaceutical companies do? In the sense that you have the, not the off-brands, but the off-patents and the generics. Do other big pharmaceutical companies have similar combinations?
Some of them do, but the generics industry really has, over the last several years, taken a beating in terms of competition from international, some supplier consolidations, and a lot of other economic types of issues that have really changed that business. So what had been a very profitable business for Mylan and other generic drug makers, it's not so much in the last several years.
Paul, Mylan has been having the financial troubles that you alluded to for at least 3-4 years. Is that due to the market that you just described, or some of the controversies the company has also encountered over that time period?
I think it's a mix. There's a lot of challenges ahead for Mylan, challenges that they're in the midst of. That generic industry shakeout is a major part of it. Their stock price is down significantly. It's down 75% from what it was in 2015. And there's the controversy over the EpiPen,
right,
which was a few years ago, and there's shortages with that and some other issues that they've had at their manufacturing plants in Morgantown and elsewhere.
They faced a lawsuit as well.
They've got yes, there's a price-fixing lawsuit by the Connecticut Attorney General, and then also there's potential liability for opioid marketing that no one's really got a handle on yet.
Do analysts think that this combination of Pfizer's Upjohn and Mylan will solve Mylan's troubles?
I think that the best way to describe that would be that I believe that Upjohn and Mylan, and this is what analysts say, are better together than they are apart.
Mm-hmm. Add the strengths together, and that helps erase some of the weaknesses, or what?
Right, and scale's a big thing, too. The bigger that you are in a generics environment, it's a tough industry. It's a tough business. It's always actually been a tough business. Those companies really scratch and have to be aggressive for everything, every bit of market share that they get, every sale.
That's interesting you say it's tough business, because we hear so many complaints. Drug prices are so high, so high, so high. Do we have any indication what this combination might do to drug prices? Because there's been mounting pressure from lawmakers at the state level in Washington, cut drug prices. Any indication at this point what this combination could do to drug prices?
That's a really good question. I don't think we know. There's a lot of unanswered questions, a lot of questions that I have, a lot of questions that analysts have, and no one really has a good handle on what's going to happen, both with the companies, with the industry, and then also with the whatever the administration will do with drug prices.
Mylan and Pfizer already have had a relationship, don't they, with the EpiPen, and is that unusual?
No, interestingly enough, there's connections and also lawsuits between drug makers all the time. They get into lawsuits over who's going to be the first to have exclusivity for a generic. They also have questions and lawsuits over patents and whether the patent's going to expire, allowing generic companies to make the drugs. There's a lot of different connections. And then also, remember, one of the things that overlays all this is that creating any kind of medication costs a lot of money. There's a lot of research and development costs on the front end. And I think that if there's ways for them to combine to work together, sometimes they do. And the EpiPen's a prime example of that.
Mylan officially headquartered in the Netherlands, corporate office in Canonsburg. What have officials said about the future of Mylan in the Pittsburgh area?
So that's one of the things that's an unanswered question. So the news release and also what they talked about on a conference call yesterday was that Canonsburg, down in South Point, their operation would be, in fact, one of the three global centers of the company. It's a global center right now for Mylan, and it's going to be that way for the new company, whatever it's going to be called. Won't be Mylan. Right. And then there's also going to be one in Shanghai and also in India.
So therefore, we also don't know impact on workforce in the region?
Right. Suggestions are that there will be some impact on the workforce. There's at least 600 to 900 people that work at the Mylan Corporate Center. And then also there is hundreds that work at the Morgantown manufacturing plant where they manufacture some of the medications.
Finally, Paul, so next steps, shareholders have to approve. What about regulatory process?
That'll be something they'll have to they'll look at, because it's a larger company. It'll be probably the largest generics manufacturer in the country. So antitrust regulators and other people will be looking at that. Those are the next two steps, really.
When do they hope to have all things settled as far as all the approvals?
Middle of 2020. What we also don't know is whether or not the actual headquarters of the company will be in Canonsburg, New York, somewhere else. They've only committed to it being incorporated in Delaware and also having the headquarters somewhere in the United States.
Paul Goff is a reporter with the Pittsburgh Business Times. Paul, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. About a million animal and plant species are threatened with extinction. A stark United Nations report earlier this year found human activities are driving this decline. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick reports on one rare butterfly that's largely disappeared from the East Coast, but has found refuge in a surprising place.
Regal fritillary butterflies used to be common across the U.S. They're still around in the Midwest, but in the East, to see them, you have to sign up for a special guided tour that happens only a few times each summer.
Everybody excited to see some butterflies today?
The group is at the Fort Indian Town Gap Military Base in Lebanon County to catch a glimpse of this charismatic insect with vivid orange wings dotted with black and white spots. On a recent July morning, visitors pile into their cars to caravan out to a grassy field.
All right, everyone, convoy's about to leave.
Wildlife biologist Mark Swartz leads the group as police direct traffic.
Updating numbers for the butterfly tour.
This is a lot of manpower for some butterflies.
Yes, it is. It takes a lot of coordination, and it occasionally breaks down, and that's when we have problems.
This time, the Air Force didn't get the memo. Swartz had them reroute their training flights at the last minute.
That's why I was a little upset that there was a problem, because they're shooting. So that's a 50 caliber machine gun.
With the plane safely out of the way, Swartz hops out of his car and leads the tour through the field. It doesn't take long to spot a butterfly flapping by. People quickly grab their cameras.
There's a Regal coming across.
A military base may seem a surprising haven for wildlife, but it can be, because it isn't welcoming to people and development. Swartz says the activity here also helps create meadows.
There may also be tanks and other military vehicles that go in and tear up the ground that essentially set back what would turn into trees back into a grassland.
It's exactly what the butterflies like, and it's where the plants they feed on grow. This is Michael Bean's second time on the tour. He drove up from Washington, D.C. for the day just to see the Regals.
It's heartwarming to see as many people as there are here today. I would guess there are 200 people or more, and that's quite remarkable to come out to see a rare insect.
No one is quite sure why the Regal fritillaries nearly disappeared in the East. About 100 miles from the base in Philadelphia, the Academy of Natural Sciences of Drexel University is home to one of the oldest insect collections in North America. Entomology curator John Gelhaus says a prominent 19th century naturalist named Titian Peale left behind many specimens and notes showing he was able to find Regal fritillaries in the city.
We can see here in Peale's handwriting, collected in the vicinity of Philadelphia by TRP, Titian Ramsey Peale, 1831.
The Regal fritillaries' decline in recent decades fits into a broader pattern of biodiversity loss, driven by factors like habitat destruction, invasive species, and climate change. Gelhaus explains butterflies are especially important to humans because, as pollinators, they play a critical role in food production.
We're not just protecting nature for some kind of ideal, intrinsic kind of value. It's wonderful we're protecting nature, aren't we good? These things actually do things for us.
Researchers are working to introduce the Regal fritillaries to new habitats in the region in hopes they can expand their range beyond the military base. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Pittsburgh's own Squonk Opera presents its new show at the Three Rivers Regatta. Who is Squonk Opera? 90.5 WESA's Bill O'Driscoll has this profile.
That's Squonk Opera rehearsing in an industrial park near Pittsburgh. The musical and performance troupe is in its 27th year. It's performed in 35 states and on 3 continents. Squonk's new show is titled Hand to Hand. In typical Squonk fashion, the half-hour outdoor spectacle combines lively, melodic art rock with inventive staging and big, crazy props. This time, the toys include 2 custom-made, 20-foot-tall inflatable puppets shaped like hands, a giant purple left hand and a giant purple right hand, palms facing the audience. Co-founder Steve O'Hearn says Hand to Hand is the group's response to the powerlessness members felt after the last presidential election. The hands are symbolic, he says.
So for us, they're simply about kind of power and the ability to do things.
Each hand stands to one side of the tall, tiered metal riser holding the 5 musicians, guitar, bass, drums, keyboard, and O'Hearn with his electronic bagpipes. Puppeteers use long ropes to bend and straighten each finger separately. The hands, mounted on wheels, will interact with the crowd.
We like to kind of empower the audience to think, oh, I could do that, and it's true, they could do it.
Squonk shows are comic, a bit surreal, even thought-provoking. The approach has made the group a favorite at Pittsburgh's Three Rivers Arts Festival, but also earned it a national reputation. David Kirkpatrick directs education programs and productions at the Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C.
I don't know if there's another company quite like them in the United States that does these outdoor shows that work for parades or works for multi-century environments outside in such a dynamic way.
In September, Hand to Hand will be part of the debut festival for the Kennedy Center's new outdoor arts campus called Reach.
Basically, when you work outside in a public space, you're accessible to everyone, and so that sort of inclusiveness of their work is really exciting.
Squonk was founded in 1992. O'Hearn, a young industrial designer and musician, teamed with composer and keyboardist Jackie Dempsey. Squonk started out playing original music in bars and nightclubs with bizarre props crafted by O'Hearn. They called themselves Opera to reflect their multidisciplinary approach, and Squonk because they weren't doing Mozart. In 1995, Squonk staged its first real spectacle titled Forgotten Works. It was produced in a local scrapyard with a dance troupe. Dempsey explains.
We built a dance floor in the junkyard, and we performed on the crushed cars. I played in the back of a pickup truck, and so we made our set right there in the junkyard. And we had a big crane that moved the crushed cars around.
Around Halloween that year, Squonk staged its first indoor theatrical show. The collaboration with City Theater was a satirical live take on George Romero's horror classic, Night of the Living Dead. The film was projected on a screen with cutouts so the Squonk players could interact with it, recalls City Theater artistic director Mark Masterson.
They played over the film, and they commented on the film, and then they kind of deconstructed the film.
Squonk Opera has been making spectacles ever since. Highlights include Big Smorgasbord Wonderwork, a banquet-themed blend of opera and circus with disembodied heads and a dinner table that grows its own mouth. The show made it to Off-Broadway and Broadway. In 2011, Squonk competed on TV's America's Got Talent. Its 2016 show, Cycle Sonic, was performed by band members mounted on high platforms moved around by pedal power. In 2017 came a residency at a massive beer festival in China. But while Hand to Hand is also touring to Houston, Rhode Island, and Illinois, the show will be a first for Squonk Opera. Its first time playing the Three Rivers Regatta in Point State Park. Dempsey, a Pittsburgh native like O'Hearn, says Squonk hopes to keep reaching new audiences.
That's a great thing, I think, to do in our hometown, to still be surprising people who are our neighbors with what we do.
Hand to Hand makes its Pittsburgh premiere with multiple shows Friday through Sunday. I'm Bill O'Driscoll, 90.5 WESA News.
And Bill O'Driscoll joins us in the studio now to talk more about Squonk. Bill, welcome.
Good morning, Kevin.
As you say in your report, Squonk is known for its props. There's dance, music, of course. They've interacted with film in the past. As a journalist, did you find it a challenge to capture just who and what Squonk is?
A little bit, yeah, because they are so unusual. And also, it's the visual element is so important with them. You can hear the music, and you can represent that on radio, obviously. But the scale of these props and the colorfulness and the sort of the silliness and playfulness of the whole spectacle is a little bit hard to capture just on radio.
Difficult to put this troop in a box of how to describe what they do, who they are?
Yeah, I think you know, there's rock bands that of course have used elements of theatricality, you know, before, whether you're talking about Genesis or Kiss or the Flaming Lips, bands like that use crazy props and things like that. But that's like part of a larger show. For Squonk, it's all like sort of one big show. The music and the visuals all kind of go together. So I think that makes them unusual.
Where do they get their inspiration? What have you learned?
I think from everywhere. I mean, they've been making these shows for 25 years or more. And I think, you know, Steve O'Hearn is the guy who plays the sort of the electronic wind instruments, like electronic bagpipes. But he was trained as an industrial designer. So he's like a visual artist. And he comes up with these surreal ideas, like giant hands or like arms that stretch out for 20 feet on either side, or dinner tables that grow their own mouths and things like that. And that combines with Jackie Dempsey, who's the keyboardist, but she's also the composer. And so their visions sort of come together, and they realize them with the help of the rest of the band and the rest of the crew.
The new show, Hand to Hand, the group's reaction to the 2016 election, do they often engage in political satire?
Not overtly, I wouldn't say. You know, the members are politically active. Some of the members are on their own. This was sort of inspired by their reaction to it. I wouldn't go there expecting there to be commentary about particular political figures in the country or anything like that. It's more about, Hand to Hand is more about how we can get together and do things as people. And the hands represent that as sort of a symbol of our ability as humans to achieve things.
Squonk of only, I believe, 5 full-time performers. So who's moving the hands?
Right. Well, 5 musicians that are going to be on this riser in the middle. The hands are going to be on either side, 20 feet tall on either side. The palms sort of facing out to the audience. Each hand will have 2 puppeteers on it, sort of using these wires. And these really look like realistic giant hands. I mean, they're fully articulated. The joints move and bend. They had them custom made in Amsterdam. So they're really something to see.
The regatta's been around for a long time. You said Squonk Opera has been around for 25, 27 years. They've been performing outdoors. Is it a surprise the troupe has never performed at the regatta before?
A little bit. I mean, they were nearly fixtures at the Three Rivers Arts Festival for years and debuted many of their shows there over the last 10 or 15 years. But somehow the regatta opportunity never really came up before. They do travel a lot. They travel to 35 states. They have kind of a year-round travel schedule, these different shows that they do, performing them in different cities. But so this year it finally came up, and so they have an opportunity to reach a new audience.
So is it meaningful there because they travel so much and they're known elsewhere? Is it meaningful for them to, you know, really to bring this Pittsburgh-born show to the Pittsburgh audience first?
Yeah, I think so. This isn't technically the debut of this show. They actually debuted it a couple weeks ago in Baltimore, This is just the Pittsburgh premiere. They usually do premiere their shows in Pittsburgh, but Steve O'Hearn and Jackie Dempsey, who are the co-founders and co-artistic directors of the group, are Pittsburgh natives. So anytime they can reach a new audience in Pittsburgh, they're really happy to do that.
Do you think they have a reputation elsewhere that maybe overwhelms their reputation locally? In other words, are they appreciated locally?
Yeah, I think they are. They're going to be playing at the Kennedy Center in September, so they do have a national reputation. But I think they're pretty well known locally. They've gotten around here.
Okay, and very quickly, Bill, when and where can people experience Squonk Opera?
At the Regatta this year, Hand to Hand will be playing 8 times over the course of Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Daytime shows. Go to the Regatta's website to find the exact times.
Bill O'Driscoll is WESA's arts and culture reporter. Bill, thanks so much.
Thanks, Kevin.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together. Next time, the Light of Life mission is breaking ground on a new facility to serve a growing need, homeless single mothers. We'll talk with the new executive director of Light of Life and what's going to happen to 11,000 Pennsylvanians who will lose their general assistance this week. If you missed anything from today's program or you'd like to catch up on past shows, please visit wesa.fm/confluence or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance by Julia Zenkovich, Julia Maruka, and Hannah Gaskill. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.